Welcome to another episode of Hip Hop Social Worker. I'm your host, Christopher Scott. And I'm sitting here with Summer Brown, a therapist out in Vancouver. Only have one microphone today. I only brought one because rushing out the house. So work with us. We're gonna get through this. So go ahead, Summer. You can go ahead and introduce yourself.
I'm Summer Brown. I'm a licensed marriage and family therapist in Vancouver, Washington. I'm in private practice, and my focus is working with people of color, gender diverse and queer folks, and people in bigger bodies. I work with individuals, couples, families, kids, teens. Right now I'm running a group that's about to end that is supporting Black women. And my website is summerbrownlmft.com, and I also do some teaching at local colleges and stuff. So, nice.
So, why why therapy?
That's a really good question. I've actually had that question a lot from even my family when I was in grad school, trying to figure out why I wanted to be a therapist. I remember a time in high school where people just used to come up to me and tell me stuff, like unload their problems, like want my advice, want just a listening ear. I think I've always been somebody who people feel connected to and feel like they can be open and transparent with. And I realized very quickly, though, that giving people advice doesn't work. Because then you're responsible in their eyes for whatever advice you gave them. And it was much more productive to be able to help people come up with a decision or make a plan that's based on what they want and fits in their values, and helping them feel empowered to make those good choices for themselves. And so I decided to complete a bachelor's degree in psychology with a minor in human sexuality. And I realized after I was done that, unfortunately, the way that I wanted to impact other people, I couldn't do with a bachelor's degree. So I went back to school and had the privilege of being able to get a master's degree, like fully acknowledging the privilege of being able to go to college in the first place. And I decided I wanted to be a counselor because I didn't see any counselor that looked like me. I didn't feel like in my experience that I had an opportunity to even go to counseling. I didn't realize it was an option. And I wanted to be somebody who could help normalize counseling for other people and normalize accessing support and care that didn't come just from church, didn't come just from, you know, family, elders giving you advice, somebody who could be objective and supportive and help me take the steps I needed to participate and engage in my life in a way that was healing and supportive.
Okay. So what kind of things do you incorporate in your practice? You know, like, so how do you figure out, you know, or how did you figure out this is the practice I'm going to do?
I think one of the other reasons that therapy has been so inaccessible to people of color is because the foundations of therapy are old white guys being the ones who make decisions about how things go, validating or invalidating the therapeutic process as a whole. And this idea of, oh, okay, so I'm broken. I have to be broken in order to feel like I can engage in my life and have therapy help me. So I pretty much engage with people in the way that I would want somebody to engage with me. So for somebody to be clear, direct, honest, affirming of who I am, and supportive, like a good listener. But I also want somebody to call me on my crap. Like, don't sugarcoat things to protect my feelings. Hold me accountable when I'm saying or doing something that doesn't match up with what I'm telling you my values are. And there's also this foundation of respect and reciprocity about the therapeutic process. So even though it's kind of intentionally one-sided with, oh, okay, so your therapist isn't going to tell you what they did all weekend. Like, your therapist is not going to introduce you to their family. Like, it's not that kind of relationship, but it requires a lot of attunement and presence and transparency in order for growth to happen. And so I try to bring that to my therapeutic work. I do a lot of solution focused therapy, which just it's just a modality that requires you to be talking about, okay, so this doesn't work for you. What do you think would work? And then making a plan for that. I do therapy called eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, which is a modality that's been proven to help reprocess trauma. Because as people of color, as women, as queer identified folks, like as people in different bodies, like all the spectrum of those intersecting identities, we experience a lot of trauma just from trying to move around the world that's not designed for us. So I do that, as well as I come from like a feminist narrative lens of people of color inherently tell stories to help people understand things. So we tell stories. We're used to being the holders of our history. Our narrative comes from spoken word versus written word. So being able to make space for people to tell stories and help you understand who they are and where they come from. And I also, because I'm a marriage and family therapist, I also really focus on systems. And so I talk a lot about attachment. So the experience that you had as a kid shapes who you are and how you move around the world now, even if it's not an adaptive way, even if it hasn't been helpful. Mm-hmm. There's a flavor of, oh, okay, so I learned when I was a kid that I was okay and the world was okay. Or I learned I'm not okay and the world is not okay. Or I learned that the world was really inconsistent and I've learned that I don't know what to expect. Yeah. It all kind of informs who we are and how we move around the world. And so I try to bring all those components into the work that I do because they're important to consider, I think. Especially when we're talking about American society, there's this idea that as individuals, we are failing. As individuals, we're broken. And that takes a lot of responsibility off of the systems and society as a whole and how those things impact individuals.
Yeah.
So.
Okay. Yeah, I was just listening to a podcast this morning. They were talking about the Michael Jackson documentary. And the guy was kind of saying that, you know, this particular case, you can't really like cancel, you know what I'm saying, people, like it's easy to get rid of them, but what we're avoiding is, you know, like we're avoiding talking about the trauma, you know what I'm saying, and how, like, you know, like how to take the good with the bad, which to me is like part of this, you know, like the system we live in is like everything has to be good. So yesterday I was thinking about how the system we live in this country kind of it really penalizes bad luck, you know what I'm saying? So like, say like you know, because car accident, you know, like you know, like there's some car accidents that are just unlucky, you know what I'm saying? Like somebody, like there's some that they're just not to blame, you know, sometimes. But then, you know, they come investigate and then they figure out, you know, who's to blame for the car accident. Or like, you know, you lose a job and you gotta, you know, like you gotta sell your home or you gotta foreclose. It's like, well, sometimes like I didn't get fired or like I wasn't being responsible. Sometimes things just happen, but somebody gotta get penalized. Right. So I feel like our system is, yeah, we could probably do a little bit of, you know, reforming, you know what I'm saying? But sorry to go off on that tangent, but so you have a private practice now, you know, would you mind explaining like some of the work you did to lead up to the private practice?
Sure. I want to go back a step though, to address what you said about sometimes this luck, and that there's always this message of somebody has to take responsibility. I think part of the reason that it's like a pendulum, right? Mm-hmm. So where nobody's taking accountability or everybody's taking accountability versus, okay, you said this thing, you did this thing, take responsibility for that and the impact it had on other people, and then grow from it.
Yeah.
Don't keep repeating the same broken pattern that doesn't work for you. And that it doesn't acknowledge that not everybody is given the same starting point. Mm-hmm. So there's that component too. But as far as private practice goes, Originally finished my degrees in California, and so I did a lot of community mental health in California. They have programs called Wraparound, where you go to people's houses and do counseling in the house or at their school. And it's kind of a team approach to supporting kids and families. When I got here, I worked at a community mental health center that was embedded in within a medical system. So I helped people navigate the medical system and the behavioral health system to get their needs met. And in graduate school, I worked at a sexual assault crisis center. So I went to hospitals and helped survivors of sexual assault with their exams and the forensic interviews and conversations with police. So I've had varied experiences working with all different kinds of people. Part of what didn't work for me about community mental health was that there's not an investment in a person. It felt like there was a lot of investment in the numbers. So like productivity, like how many minutes are you spending with this person and how much can we get paid for that, versus the idea of like wanting people to heal, wanting people to like be able to move forward. And I find that private practice gives me the flexibility to show up for people and not have to worry about how many times I've seen them or whether or not the work we do together is demonstrable through a progress note or whatever. Yeah. That was part of what brought me here. Also, I haven't had such positive experiences being a fat, queer, Black woman in the workplace, like just in general. Like I'm not even specifically talking about in mental health, but just in general. I keep coming across this quote that says, like, when your skin is viewed as a weapon, like you're never unarmed. And this idea of, okay, so I'm Black, so obviously I'm angry. I'm Black, I'm obviously uneducated. So pushing against those narratives all the time is exhausting and makes it really difficult for you to physically and emotionally show up for your clients. And now that I don't have to do that, I have so much more capacity to be able to do good work with people and help them move towards like wellness, whatever that means for them. So my journey was a lot of like missteps of, okay, I want to do this, but I'm really hesitant about leaving my full-time job. So I worked a full-time job and did this part-time and exhausted myself. And I was finally like, you know what? I can't do it all. I have to choose the best way to take care of myself and still be able to support my family. And so private practice was that for me. And it gave me the flexibility of building my own schedule, seeing the clients that that I feel I can be most effective with.
Yeah.
And so it represented a lot of flexibility and just better outcomes, like being able to do better work.
Okay. Oh, so yeah, that was good. I feel like that is like everybody's goal, like, because for most people who get into this field, you know what I'm saying, like you want to make change. And I feel like sometimes you being connected with the productivity is hard to make that change, because you know there's grants or there's funding that is connected with productivity. I remember being an intern at a juvenile rehab and having the case managers, part of their job was to call the insurance and explain why the kid needed to stay. It's like, that just seems very counterproductive to rehab, you know what I'm saying? But when it's a business, it's a business, you know? But in a business like therapy or in a practice, you know, like in a field of therapy where it can look different from somebody who doesn't really understand on the outside looking in, you know, how do you gauge, when you're successful, like, you know, when you're making that connection with the client?
One of the early lessons I learned in grad school is my instructors, my professors were like, you know, the goal is for your client to fire you, to say like, you know what, I've made so much progress. I've learned so much. I've been able to apply these tools that we've been talking about for however long, I've been able to apply them regularly. I feel like I've got some good stuff in my toolbox. I think I'm ready to be done. Mm-hmm. I think that's how I gauge success. Like when people are able to be engaged and participate in their lives in ways that are important to them. And also the flavor of having to acknowledge that I probably am not going to be the only therapist you see your whole life. So if I've created a space where therapy is safe and comfortable for you, even if I'm not the therapist that will work for you, being able to know that therapy is an option moving forward. So say you graduate, you're done, you stop coming to therapy for a while, a couple years down the line, something's going on in your life that's rough. You go, oh, I can't get to summer, but you know what? I can probably find another therapist and feel connected to that idea that therapy can be helpful. Mm-hmm. And that to me is what success is in terms of being a therapist and doing good work.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Cause thank you for that. I know there's a lot of, you know, critics, people don't really understand therapy and it's like, but you know, it's so helpful, but only to a person who understands it. You know what I'm saying? Like, so, but there's a lot of misconceptions about it, you know, but it's like, it does help, you know, if you believe it will help, you know? So, how does a race play into the practice that you built?
I think that race, specifically has been a cornerstone of my practice in terms of the reason that I went to grad school was to be able to see therapists who look like me. And I think that all the other identities, in terms of being a woman, in terms of being fat, in terms of being queer, like those identities I feel like are, you know, easier to access than the idea of being able to have a black therapist. And I pretty often have people reaching out to me saying, your intersecting identities are exactly who I am. And I've been looking for someone who I feel like represents me. And I feel like overall people just tell me, like, I have less to explain to you than I've had to explain to white therapists or other therapists. Like, I don't have to explain to you that my hair changed and what happened with my hair. We don't have to have a conversation about it. Or I don't have to tell you that when I say my auntie, I don't mean my blood auntie. Like, you know what I mean? I don't have to explain to you that work is hard, that going to work is hard, and I feel like I'm being discriminated against.
Yeah.
There's just kind of this innate knowing about some of the experiences people share to me, but I feel like it's important to still ask, like, but what does that mean to you? So I have an understanding of what that has meant to me and other people, but what does it mean to you and how does it impact you? Because it may be something different than something I've heard before. It may be exactly the same.
Yeah.
But when we're talking about race and those identity pieces, it boils down to, I want to be with somebody who feels safe.
Mm-hmm.
And oftentimes, our race, our ethnicity, our cultural identity is something that people find sameness in and feel safety.
Yeah. Yeah, you brought up a good point and kind of ties it to my next question because, you know, like, how does race and mental health connect, you know? So, like, you know, my current supervisor for my LCSW is a woman of color. And, you know, we don't have to kind of have, like, she doesn't second guess me if I said that, you know, well, there's something going on at work that might be, you know, because I'm black. She doesn't be like, well, you know, like, I feel like, I mean, not to say that it has to happen, you know, like if you have a therapist supervisor that's white, but mm-hmm. at the same time, that's a possibility that things sound like they might downplay it. Like, well, like, are you sure that's why it's happening? And it's like, we don't always want to hear that, you know what I'm saying? Like, we don't always want to be, like, second-guess, like, if it's racist, it's racist. You know, like, that's just, that it is what it is. You know, like, if I feel like it's racist, and she told me that, too, like, you know, in your gut, if you feel like it's because of your race, then it's probably because of your race, you know? So, but that kind of plays into it. Like, so how do you think race and mental health connect?
I think that there is a disconnect from being able to identify what we're experiencing and the barriers and the genetics and the intergenerational trauma, like all those flavors. I think a lot of times there's a sense of like, well, oh, just deal with it. Like, I had to deal with it. You just deal with it too. Like, it's part of it. But again, if we're talking about being able to participate and engage in our lives in a way that feels good, how does being numb or being avoidant or being disconnected, how do those things all line up? They don't, right? Yeah. And so when we're talking about mental health in the Black community, oftentimes we're talking about first having to acknowledge the things that are going on, and that in itself is painful. Yeah. Then we have to say, okay, like, which pieces of it do I have control over? Oh, hey, there's a whole bunch of it I don't have control over. Okay, so how do I keep going? And then that's when we start to have the conversations about how mental health and physical health and like the smooshing together of all that, how it's important and it should be of value to us, and we should let each other know that it's valuable. Mm-hmm. My grandma still asked me, like, so what is a therapist? Like, what do you do? Like, what do you, I don't understand. Right.
Yeah.
And it's difficult for people to find value in being vulnerable because it's uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And so in terms of in the Black community, there's kind of this like, okay, we're uncomfortable all the time. Why am I going to pay somebody to go be uncomfortable with them?
Yeah.
Well, what if I told you you could feel 5% better? Would that be worth it to you? Mm. And I've never had anybody say no. And that's what it boils down to. If it could be a little bit easier to get out of bed, if it could be a little bit easier to have tough conversations with people who matter to you, if it could be easier to take good care of yourself, like, would it be worth it?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I mean, that's a good point. It's like, you know, what if you could, you know, what if you could feel 5% better? Because 5%, I mean, that's a lot. You know what I'm saying? And that can be a significant time that, you know, instead of, well, even 1% better. It's like, mm-hmm. if you're always numb, if you're always, you know, feel beat down, somebody can just add some relief. You know, that's a positive. So what do you think, like, would be a good, like, solution, you know what I'm saying, for communities of color to kind of, I know now, you know what I'm saying, in society, you know, we're embracing therapy a little more. Mm-hmm. But like, what do you think would be like, a good way to contribute to like us having like overall awareness of our mental health, you know, why it's important, you know what I'm saying, why it's important to talk to someone, why it's important not to be numb, why it's important not to really have like, you know what I'm saying, like a survivor's mentality, you know what I'm saying, like why is it important to be open, you know what I'm saying, like to talk about, you know what I'm saying, why I'm hurt, you know?
I hate to be that person who asks a question, answers a question with a question, but how many times did you see Black Panther?
I saw Black Panther. Well, okay, disclaimer. I didn't watch it more than I watched the Avengers movie.
Okay.
But I did watch Black Panther at least 10 times.
Okay. And why did you watch it so much?
Well, short answer, for the culture. You know what I'm saying? Really just because it... Because I felt like I had to support something that big. You know what I'm saying? I felt like it was something that was not really something you see every day. You know what I'm saying? Like, they made Africa look beautiful, even though it was a fictional country. They still put the work in. We see like a lot of people who won Oscars for Black Panther, not really for like the huge awards, but for the representation of it, you know, the design of the set, the design of the clothes, you know what I'm saying? Things like that, which to me is more important than Best Picture, you know what I'm saying? So, but yeah, I watched it just because it was about Africa, you know what I'm saying? It was about a cool Africa. And sometimes you think about like, well, what if, you know, if there wasn't, you know, the raping and pillage and the slavery, like, you know, could it be what it is? Because we all know that Africa holds a lot of important stuff that makes our phones, our computers, you know, that thing. So, like, if we didn't have that trauma connected to it, you know what I'm saying, that kind of colonization, you know, could it look like that? So, yeah, I watched it more than I watch any, like, the average movie, you know what I'm saying?
So, you watched it because it was... it created a dialogue, right? Mm-hmm. Created a dialogue about, got some wheels turning in your head, created some opportunities for like visibility. Mm-hmm. And there was something like empowering and connecting about it.
Yeah.
So when we're talking about mental health, those things are all the same thing. Like, nobody knew we needed a Black Panther till we had a Black Panther. And they're like, dude, what took so long? Like, let's make all of the movies, right? Same thing goes with mental health. Like, sometimes we don't know we're having an issue with something or that there's something missing until we, like, are aware of it.
Yeah.
So when we're talking about mental health, a lot of times people don't realize that the way that Black people experience anxiety and depression is different than the way that white people do, right? So when we look at rates of maternal death in Black women compared to white women, when we look at autoimmune diseases and how they show up differently than, like, as in terms of frequency, like, all those are components of mental health, right? When we're talking about stress and the way that it impacts our bodies and the hormones and all that stuff that it does to us, if we were able to talk about mental health with the freedom that we do about Wakanda, right?
Yeah.
It'd be like, you know what? I have been feeling kind of crappy lately. I should probably go to the doctor, right? Oh, the doctor told me that these hormone levels are off, or I need to be doing other things to take care of myself, or hey, the doctor made this connection, or my therapist made this connection about stress and how it impacts my day-to-day life.
Yeah.
It's about, again, creating understanding, creating a dialogue, feeling a sense of empowerment, understanding that just because it's not something that we normally talk about doesn't mean that it's not present for all of us in some kind of way, yeah, and normalizing those conversations about it.
Okay, yeah, that was good. Because I feel like, you know, because I'm in the field of, you know, mental health and stuff, I talk to a lot of people of color that know what you just said, you know, but I didn't realize that it's not as easy for some until I had an episode where my play cousin, I talked to him about, like, you know, mental health, and he couldn't connect, like, why he was feeling what he's feeling. And if I told him, like, well, I'm so in tune with just both, and, you know, because I've been trained, I just kind of know where all my stuff comes from. But I didn't realize that it's not that easy for everyone, you know what I'm saying? Because I've just been around mental health professionals for the last 6 years, you know what I'm saying? And so, yeah, it's just so, I feel like it's important, you know what I'm saying, for at least, you know, for people like, you know, us to kind of go out and just have, like, you know, workshops and, you know, community forums and, like, you know, say, hey, you know, like, this could be why you're doing this, you know what I'm saying? This could be why you're feeling this way. You know, this could be why, you know, like, if you're drinking too much, yeah, you might be having fun in the moment, but let's see how that's affecting you, you know? You know, so, so you're actually, like, one of my first guests that, like, you know, that has, like, the intersectionality that you do, you know what I'm saying? So I just kind of want to talk about that a little bit, you know what I'm saying? Like, you know, I'm not really familiar with a lot of the terms that, you know, like what it means to be queer, you know what I'm saying? I know, like, that's, yeah, I'm just not really familiar with, like, what that actually means, you know what I'm saying? Like, you know, this, I know it has something to do with, you know, sexuality, but I just don't know what it, you know, like, the specifics of it. And, you know, just talking about, like, you know, like, being a Black feminist, you know, how that is, you know what I'm saying, being somebody who's body positive, you know, there's a lot of stuff in the media. I know my wife was mad about, there was a Nike ad the other day, and in the comments it was saying, like, well, why would Nike want to promote obesity and that kind of stuff? So, like, you want to just touch on some of those things, you know what I'm saying, just in how you prepare for that battle every day, you know what I'm saying, and how you prepare your clients for that battle every day, you know, so.
So, I would probably say I use queer as a term that's an umbrella. So underneath it would be lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, androgynous, asexual, pansexual, like, kind of all the flavors of pretty much everybody who's not heterosexual. Okay. Not everybody's comfortable with that term, but it's a term that feels like it fits my experience. And I openly use the term fat to identify my body because there's been many a time where like fat has been thrown at me as like a derogatory thing. When really when it boils down to it, it's like telling somebody, oh, you have a leg. Like yeah. Everybody has fat. Yeah. Everybody has components of their body that help it function, right? Mm-hmm. The way that it does. So I definitely identify as being a feminist. It's difficult though, because people have some misunderstandings about what feminism is. Feminism to me is about dismantling systems of oppression that cater to what used to be the norm of American society. So a whole bunch of white dudes, right? A whole bunch of white women, right? So for me, feminism is about giving everybody equal access to the resources that are here, mm-hmm. And dismantling those systems that create that divide between the people who need the resources and the people who are hoarding them.
Yeah.
So when it boils down to it, my identity as a queer person is, it's pretty hidden. I mean, I'm cisgendered. So cisgendered means like the gender I was assigned at birth matches my gender presentation as I am now. So unless you see me out with a partner, you don't know that I'm not a straight person, right? Because the idea is that everyone is assumed to be straight. Yeah. Everyone is assumed to be able-bodied. Mm-hmm. Everybody's assumed to have the gender that was assigned at birth be the one that matches them. So the only time I ever have to talk about it is it every single time I have to talk about it, it's like a little bit of an outing process for myself. People have to shift their perceptions about me, whereas me being black and me being fat, like those things are out there. You see me, you know I'm fat. You see me, you know I'm black, right? And it's just those kinds of things. I think when they show up in therapy, it really pushes me towards being able to have some tougher conversations with people, some conversations about acknowledging their privileges, me acknowledging mine, and then also being able to acknowledge for them that just because you have privileges doesn't mean that you haven't struggled. And just because you've struggled doesn't mean you don't have privileges.
Yeah.
So the idea that, oh, you mean I can be privileged and be systemically non-dominant at the same time? Like, what? And so when we're talking about queer identity and how it shows up in therapy, I feel like oftentimes what I do is I just try to be really aware of the other person's experience in a way that's different than somebody, I guess, who doesn't have to think about it, who has the privilege of not having to think about it. So my intake documents ask people for nicknames or names they like to be called, ask for gender, pronouns, are people in monogamous or non-monogamous relationships? Like, I can't assume that everybody's got a mom and a dad. So I ask people, like, who are the caregivers in your life? Not everybody is connected to their biological family. So who are the chosen family that you have, and how do you connect to them? Acknowledging that not everybody has a network of people who are accepting and affirming of them and openly having those conversations about what that's like. Mm-hmm. And again, asking about people if they have chronic illnesses or any physical limitations that we need to talk about, because I can't assume that everybody's going to show up to me able-bodied, cisgendered, financially like well off. Like, those are things that I think a lot of times when you don't approach it from an intersectional lens, those are things that get missed, and therefore you're missing the person's narrative. So I openly tell people who I am.
Yeah.
Just because it's important for them to know who they're getting when they meet me.
Okay. Yeah, that's real. So, like, do you serve, like, a certain group when, you know, for your private practice? How did you kind of get to that point to know, like, this is, like, my specific clientele?
That was a process in itself. I think that when we're learning new skills, we approach things with a lot of curiosity and a lot of openness to, like, we'll see what happens. Mm-hmm. And that worked, you know, fine in the beginning. But as I realized, the folks that I feel like are most looking for someone with my experience, and the folks that I really find the most joy of supporting, it really helped me hone down who it is that I'm working with. I don't turn anyone away. Yeah. That's not my thing. But I do make it pretty clear that there are specific systemically non-dominant groups that need space that feels safe for them. Mm-hmm. And so I just kind of was like, you know what? I'm just going to say who I am and we'll see what happens. Yeah. I have, on my literature and in my discussions with people, I let them know, like, so I serve systemically non-dominant groups that are queer, people of color, people in bigger bodies. And most of the time, the people who identify with those qualities or personality traits or demographics, they find me.
So, you know, as a person that's been working and trying to, you know, just trying to figure out, you know, my own clientele and, you know, build my own private practice, you know, slowly but surely, you know, what could you kind of say about the grind of the building, you know, saying the clientele to where people find you, you know, because I'm sure, well, I'm assuming, but I'm sure, like, you know, the first day you open, you know, saying, or you had the idea, it probably wasn't like, you know, just like, oh, well, hey, I found you, you know what I'm saying? So you want to explain a little bit about the grind of the private practice?
Sure. I think one of the important points would be when you're building a private practice, it's a lot of front loading. So try to get as much preparation stuff done in the first place that you can. Do all the paperwork, apply for all the insurance panels, do all that stuff. Do a lot of networking. Figure out what things you want to work on with people and hone those skills. Get better at doing those things. Get better at your being able to have a dialogue with people about who you are, because that's a big part of it. And then once you do that, then it's kind of just a waiting game, unfortunately. But I think because of, like, of what I know of you so far, I think that you shouldn't have any problems building a private practice. Mm-hmm. There is a shortage of Black therapists and an even bigger divide when we're talking about Black male therapists. Mm-hmm. And in terms of being able to figure out, like, get a sense of, like, what's going on in the community and what services are needed and go from there. Okay.
Yeah, I noticed, you know, I wasn't, like, when I, you know, when I went live on my website, I didn't really have, like, a lot of information on there to get in contact with me. Like, I'm assuming that everybody feels comfortable with, like, just emailing me stuff, which some people do, you know what I'm saying? But, you know, but it's more like, you know, students and people just, you know, that I kind of know already. But, like, I didn't have a, you know, like, I didn't publish, like, a schedule. I didn't make, like, you know, a referral process, which I'm kind of working on now. Like, you know, a privacy policy, you know what I'm saying? And just, like, an intake form. A lot of stuff that, like, I just kind of assumed people would just reach out for. I didn't provide it. So now I'm like, okay, so now I'm in the process of kind of honing that stuff in. Things like that, really. And really trying to, you know, because I'm in the process of getting licensure and really trying to see, like, you know, what things I can do legally and not, you know, kind of you know, put myself at risk of, like, the board saying, like, oh, well, you shouldn't have did that when you were just a CSWA. You should have waited, or you should have had somebody do something. So you know, I'm very limited, but I did know that there's a lot of stuff that I didn't do on my end to kind of make it easy. Because, like you said, a lot of people are not going to ask, like, people are not going to, you know, like, well, why do I need to see that? Or, like, if it's too hard, I'm not going to do it, you know. So I feel like my responsibility to the community and to people that I want to serve is to kind of make it is like as soft as possible, you know what I'm saying? Like, make it just as easy as possible, you know? So, let's see. So how do you take care of yourself, you know, as a person who, You know, I posted something on Instagram about, you know, like the compassion fatigue of this work. So like, how do you stay engaged in the, you know, to stay like, you know, hearing all the hard stuff you might hear and just kind of all the problems you work through? Like, how do you stay in tune and, you know, self-aware?
So that's kind of a multifaceted question. So when I work with people, I try to help them build up their coping skills. Mm-hmm. And so in order to not be a hypocrite, I need to have good coping skills too. Yeah. So what that looks like is I like to read. I like to schedule myself nope days where I put in my calendar nope. And when somebody asks me for something, I say nope. And I just shuffle around the house in my pajamas or do whatever it is that I need to do to get done that day just for myself. I like to take baths. I like to do yoga. I like to spend quality time with important people in my life. Those are some of the ways that I take care of myself. The other things that I do are more logistical. So I take notes in session, and then when my session is over, I put those notes away. And I try not to carry around everybody's narrative all the time. Like, I figured out a pretty good way of leaving work at work. Mm-hmm. Take my notes, put them away, finish the progress notes in the computer, put that, file away that information until the next time I see somebody. There's lots of books on trauma stewardship and vicarious trauma in terms of understanding that trauma is something that happens to us but isn't about us. And being in somebody's trauma with them, we have to be able to moderate, like, okay, what stuff is mine, what stuff is theirs? Because if we're carrying their stuff around for them, we don't have the capacity to help them. The other thing that I like to do, I like to create stuff. So I write, I paint, I draw, I like to craft, I listen to music, dance around my house, like all that kind of stuff. Try to make and eat good food because I really enjoy food. I like to travel. So, like, a lot of those things are a privilege. Like, I fully acknowledge that it takes financial resources to be able to do most of the things I listed. But also, I mean, if I don't have the resources to do it, maybe I just go outside and sit in the sun. Go for a walk, call a friend, hang out with my pets and my kids. Sometimes it doesn't, I try not to have it take more from me than it gives to me. Yeah. And so in terms of kind of just trying things out, seeing if it helps, if it doesn't help, don't do it. If it helps, do it more, that kind of stuff.
Nice. I remember being in grad school and seeing an article saying that, you know, self-care isn't always about the shopping and the bubble baths. Sometimes it's just about doing the dishes, you know. So I like to, you know, see what other people do for self-care, you know, because it's not always lavish, you know. I feel like that's the misconception. It's like it has to be. But like you said, if I don't have the resources to do it, I'll just go outside and chill, you know what I'm saying? Or I just, you know, do just something that's not as drastic, but still both, you know, reassuring and healthy and gets me back in tune. So what is, you know, the goal for, you know, Summer Brown's private practice and therapeutic career?
I'm always trying to develop more stuff. We have not figured out how to clone people yet, and there's only one of me, so I can only do so much. I'd like to write a book. I'd like to do more teaching. I'd like to continue education opportunities, like workshops and stuff. I just really enjoy meeting people and sharing space with people and creating opportunities for people to connect and grow. So as far as like professionally, those are some of my goals. Continue doing great work with people, showing up, helping people feel better. In my personal life, I feel like some of my goals are like traveling, relaxing And I feel like some of those things are directly connected to my professional goals. But I also want to continue to learn. I'm always toying with the idea of going back to school and I could do human sexuality degree. I could go back to school and be a psych nurse so I can prescribe medication. Like, I'm always just thinking about ways to expand and create other opportunities to support our community. So, I mean, I feel like there's nothing I'm not going to do.
Nice. I feel like, in this field we work in, and the more creative we get, the more outlets we see that we can do. You know, like before I actually got into the place of being where I'm at right now with my creativity, I really was just okay with just, you know, getting a job and working 8 to 5 and going home, you know what I'm saying? But then when I was in grad school, I would meet people like you, or meet people like who would speak at these conferences and speak so well, and people would just like get up and just give a round of applause, and people would just be so proud. It's like, you know, that's kind of tight. I would like to be in that realm, you know what I'm saying? So I'm glad that, for being introduced to podcasting by my good friend, you know what I'm saying? So since I aspire to this because, you know, I started Hip Hop Social Worker in 2015 while I was in grad school, but I didn't know what to do with it. But I knew I wanted to do something with it, you know. But I knew, like, I was in school, so, like, I couldn't really have a website that was, like, you know, I was like, why would I have a website? I can't do anything, you know what I'm saying? I can't provide any services. I can't. So it'd be just a waste of money. But now since I'm, like, you know, I'm doing my podcasting. And the podcasting is really just, so, like, if, you know, I get, like, an opportunity to speak somewhere, or somebody says, you know, if I meet somebody and I say, hey, I'd like to come speak at your school or something, and they say, well, what have you done? I can say, oh, I have this link. You can go to my link and you can hear the kind of content that I provide, hear my story, you know what I'm saying, hear just a little bit about me. So that was the goal, just so I could practice, you know. And I feel like it has helped because, you know, like I have a stutter, and the more episodes that I do, I feel like I'm more comfortable with, like, speaking on a microphone, you know what I'm saying? But not to talk about myself like that, but, you know, just kind of ideas of goals that, you know, that we, it's important to have goals. And I would like to, you know, like, speak to students in either in getting their undergrad in social work or getting their master's in social work and say, hey, you know, I know schools don't really tell you to go get the money or go get the notoriety, but it's not, you're not wrong if you want that. You know, like, I know there's this, like, I don't know how it is in counseling, but in social work, it's like this thing of, like, if you want to get paid, you're not a good social worker. But it's like, nah, like, I feel like, you know, like, this school's charging me, you know, so all this money to come here. I feel like I should want, if I want to, I should be able to do that, you know. There's some people who don't have to do that, and that's fine, you know what I'm saying? But I feel like, you know, just like how, you know, we have, like it's nice to have, like, equity in everything. You know, there's some people who are going to do it for the love. Just like there's some artists who don't want to go platinum. You know, they just cool with making CDs, you know, and they see, or making our songs in their garage, and they're fine with that. You know what I'm saying? But there's people who want to be known, and we should have the space for all that, you know. So I feel like that's fair. Oh, go
ahead. So part of my pushback about that idea of, like, doing anything for altruistic reasons is nothing can be 100% altruistic. Like, we can't just exist for the betterment of other people at the detriment of ourselves. So the fact that social work and...
What does altruism mean?
So altruism is this idea that if you're doing good stuff, it's for the like idea of being able to do good stuff. Which isn't bad.
Yeah.
Right? Like, we all want to do good things for the sake of it being good. But again, it goes back to that idea of, like, if I'm doing good things for the sake of being good at the cost of myself, then is it really good? So when we talk about historically counseling and social work and helping professions, yeah, the founding folks of it were old white guys, and they're the ones who legitimized therapy as a whole. But when you look at the last 50, 60 years, most counselors are women. right? And it goes to that idea of, okay, so we're undervaluing mental health. We're undervaluing the emotional labor and work of women, right? And if you're somebody who wants to do this work and be able to financially support yourself, then you don't have altruistic reasons for it, right? Like, it's then your whole reason for being a helper person is broken, because you want to be able to take care of yourself, or you want to be able to be successful at it. That's something that I feel like a lot of counselors, we end up struggling with, because we need to be able to have good boundaries to do the work we do. We need to be able to take care of ourselves to be able to continue the work we do. So it makes sense that we should be compensated for the work that we're doing. So if we're talking about speaking engagements, continuing education, we're talking about teaching, we're talking about, you know, doing individual, family, couples work, it makes sense that we should be compensated for our experience in education. And I really think it's important for us to not feel guilty about needing to take care of ourselves. So, yes. And it's also okay to want to be successful and well-known and be good at what you do. Because I don't think we'd ever tell somebody else, go do what you want to do, be really great at it, but also don't make any money.
Yeah.
Like, don't worry about, like, paying your bills and stuff. Don't worry about being able to have access to resources to take care of yourself and your family. Like, you're supposed to just want to do it because you're a good person.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I get turned off when I see jobs that start with, like, we don't do this for the check. It's like, see, you're trying to finesse, you know, and I can't get finessed. Not today, you know what I'm saying? So before we go, do you want to, you know, I know you plugged your business in the front end of the episode, but do you want to, you know, just go ahead and tell people again who you are, what you got going on, where they can find you, XYZ?
So, once again, my name is Summer Brown. I'm a licensed marriage and family therapist in Vancouver, Washington. I'm licensed in California and Oregon and Washington. I do individual, couples, families. I work with kids, teens, adults. I do teletherapy in the states I'm licensed in as well. I also provide clinical supervision to up-and-coming counselors under the mentorship of an AMFT-approved counselor supervisor. I have taught at Lewis and Clark College in their graduate program. I teach currently at Clark College in the Human Development Department. I've done workshops. I'm a board member of the Pacific Northwest Providers. I am an active member. I just got accepted, actually, to the PALF I Am Your Sister Leadership Conference. So I'm doing that as well. I like to write. I have a Instagram that is devoted to, like, my poetry and stuff. There's not much on it, but it's at The Chocolate Chronicles, T-H-A-C-H-O-C-O-L-A-T-E-C-H-R-O-N-I-C-L-E-S, Chocolate Chronicles. I have a website. It's summerbrownlmft.com. If I'm doing stuff, I usually try to update it and put it on that website.
Okay. I appreciate you. And, yeah, it was a good talk. Learned some things, you know what I'm saying? keep learning, because we have to. So, yeah, everybody listen to the episode. Appreciate everybody. I am C4.com. If you are a clinician of color looking for other clinicians of colors to build with, or, you know, if you're looking for a clinician of color, you can go to c4pdx.com, and there's more information there for you. And, yeah, always hiphopsocialworker.com. I'm on Instagram, hiphopsocialworker, Facebook, hiphopsocialworker, Twitter, hhsocialwork, and Gmail, hiphopsocialworker@gmail.com. I appreciate everybody for listening. I appreciate Summer for sitting down and sharing her wealth of knowledge with me and teaching me a good word. A new word. I'm gonna have to go back and listen to that again so I can get that down packet. That was a good word. What was it again?
Altruism.
I might name the episode that. All right, thank you. welcome back. Now it is time for the part of the show where I say the diagnosis of the week. Since we were talking about Summer and I were talking about body images and being body positive, I thought I would pick a diagnosis that was something that relates to that. So the diagnosis of this week is body dysmorphic disorder. The diagnostic criteria: preoccupation with one or more perceived defects or flaws in physical appearance that are not observable or appear slight to others. At some point during the course of the disorder, the individuals have performed repetitive behaviors, e.g. mirror checking, excessive grooming, skin picking, reassurance seeking, or mental acts, e.g. comparing his or her appearance to others in response to the appearance concerns. The preoccupation causes clinically significant distress or impairment in social, occupational, or other important areas of functioning. The appearance preoccupation is not better explained by concerns or body fat or weight or in an individual whose symptoms meet diagnostic criteria for an eating disorder. Specify is if. With muscle dysmorphia, the individual is preoccupied with the idea that his or her body build is too small or insignificantly muscular. The specifier is used even in individuals preoccupied with other body areas, which is often the case. Specify if, indicate degree or insight regarding body dysmorphia disorder beliefs, e.g., I look ugly or I look deformed. With in bold, with good or fair insight, the individual recognizes that the body dysmorphic disorder beliefs are definitely or probably not true, or that they may or may not be true. With poor insight, the individual thinks that the body dysmorphic disorder beliefs are probably true. With absent insight, delusional beliefs, the individual is completely convinced that the body dysmorphic disorder beliefs are true. All right, so that's our diagnosis of the week. If you are a person who heard those diagnostic criteria and it might sound familiar, don't be afraid to reach out to someone that maybe be a mental health professional or someone you might trust to hold your concerns with seriousness and not turn around and crack a joke or anything like that. Saying if you really are concerned, you should talk to someone who is genuine and cares about your best interest. Not saying that people that crack jokes on you don't have your best interest, but sometimes you need to take your mental health a little bit seriously. We all can't keep deflecting with jokes. Some not a very healthy coping mechanism. Our coping skill. So yeah, today was daylight savings time, and that hour really took it out of me. But anyway, so yeah, it's another episode. I appreciate Summer Brown for connecting and having a good interview. A lot of stuff that I learned from that interview, and it's just a lot of stuff that I really don't really think about. Like, I really didn't know that there was like a body positive thing going on. But it's good. I like it. It's important, that everybody gets their fair share of treatment. We don't need to have, we just don't need to have, people out here that can't get served. Everybody needs somebody to sit down and talk to, whether it be therapy or just like casually venting, or we should be able to provide everybody services. Coming up May 11th, I'll be at the Rose City Initiative for the Unapologetically Well Tour, put on by Ashley McGirt. It's going to be a pretty good event. That's my first time really being on a bill speaking about mental health, so we'll see how that goes, and we're also going to talk about some toxic masculinity. I'm curious to know, how it's going to go, because my ideas probably, won't be, supported by everyone. I'm assuming that's going to be some pushback somewhere. just curious to know where. But once again, another episode of Hip Hop Social Worker Podcast. You can find me on hiphopsocialworker.com and everywhere else. I'll holler at y'all. Peace.
The podcast you just heard was made using Anchor. Ever thought about making your own podcast? Anchor makes it really easy for anyone to get started. It's a one-stop shop for recording, hosting, and distributing podcasts. Best of all, it's 100% free. Sign up now at anchor.fm/new. That's anchor.fm/new to get started.